Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. I am Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm very pleased to be joined today by Nicholas Jarecki. Nicholas Jarecki, he is the writer and director of Arbitrage, starring Richard Gere, came out in, was that 2013?
Yeah, 2012, 2013.
Very good. It's on Showtime now if you want to check that out. You wrote The Informers, and you're the writer and director of a new movie about the opioid epidemic called Crisis, and that's what we are here to discuss today. Out on Blu-ray and DVD this week. You can check it out on physical media if you're not into the whole streaming thing. But I was very interested in this movie because I used to edit in a past life. I used to edit a writer who was very into covering the whole opioid crisis. He was very into the rise of fentanyl and all that. And all of this is discussed here. I mean, I think it's an under-discussed topic. You know, we've had in the last in the 12-month period ending in September 2020, there were 87,000 plus drug overdoses, most of those opioids. You know, that's almost twice as many Americans as were killed in Vietnam, right? The opioid epidemic has cost billions in medical care, lost productivity, et cetera, but it's kind of a hard topic to make a movie about, right?
Well, first of all, Sonny, thank you so much for having me here. I'm a fan of your writing. And by the way, I just have to ask a question. This may be a little bit off topic, but Sonny Bunch, is that a real name? Yes.
It is a real name. It is a family nickname. So it's not technically what's on my birth certificate, but it
okay, is. Okay, because I've heard Sonny Bunch in other contexts, you know. So I was wondering if it was a nom de guerre.
Hopefully they're positive, mostly.
Yes, absolutely. So was it a hard movie to make a story about? Well, I thought, you know, it's the perfect thing for one of these multi-plot treatments, or I guess some people now refer to them as hyperlink cinema, although I'm not sure I love that description. But, you know, there's a tradition in cinema that I think, you know, not enough people talk about, sort of started with Robert Altman, you know, where he really pioneered or made big this idea of the multiple narrative cinema. And oftentimes those films will hang out on a particular topic. You saw it in Nashville, you know, and he would do later, you know, The Player with Hollywood or Prêt-à-Porter, the fashion industry, whatever, what have you. And then the wonderful stories of Raymond Carver that he did in Shortcuts. And so I like that type of cinema. And you know, Soderbergh had done it wonderfully with Traffic, but then Iñárritu also 21 Grams, Amores Perros, mm-hmm. Babel, right? And so this was a style of cinema that was very popular in the 90s and 2000s. And then it kind of went away. And, you know, I think it was somewhat supplanted by television because people are used to the multi-narrative threads in television. So, but I felt like, hey, it's time to bring this back because audiences always enjoyed those films. You know, there's very few of them that didn't catch. But you know, you've got to have a subject that merits it. So there's always this dance as a creator between, well, is it the form or is it the content? Because a movie's kind of both, right? What you love about a thriller maybe is the story, but maybe it's also like how the thriller works and, you know, get you on the edge of your seat, twist you over here, you know. So it's a dance. But, you know, I had personal experience with the opioid topic. I had lost a good friend to opioid abuse. He died, started with pills, went into heroin. And I knew other people that had struggled with it. So I you know, wanted to make some sense of it personally, but I also thought it would be ripe for cinematic exploration. And indeed, I think it was. But we said, okay, well, how are we going to do it? So we got to look at it from three angles. Law enforcement, which is, you know, the character that Armie Hammer plays and the Michelle Rodriguez storyline. We want to look at a user. And what happens to her. That's Evangeline Lilly playing an architect who's a recovering addict. And then we want to look at production, and how these drugs come to be on the pharmaceutical side, and where Gary Oldman plays a university researcher working for Big Pharma, and a kind of whistleblower story. So all these stories came to be from the research that I did. I'm very research heavy as a filmmaker. I love it. I like getting in with the real people, hearing their stories. Pretty much everything in this movie happened. So it's just a question of, you know, did I change it or did I put it through a little prism or move details around? But it's very true to life. So I thought, you know, this really fit the subject matter well. And so I didn't think it was too difficult to fashion, a story. Whether or not I did it well, I guess that's up to you.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the research here, because I mean, it feels like, again, a very deeply researched film. There was without being kind of didactic and pedantic about it, you know, just rattling off information or stats, right? It feels natural to the narrative. But I want to talk to you a little bit about your research process. I mean, when you were sitting down for interviews with people, do you just like call them up and say, "Hey, I'm directing this movie about opioids. Can you spare 20 minutes to talk to me?" I mean, how does that all work? I know how it works for a reporter, but I'm curious how it works for a filmmaker.
Well, there's no set path. You know, it's every time you kind of start over and you go like, "Gee, what now? What?" With this, I had the idea, and at the time, actually, it's interesting genesis. I thought I was having a hearing problem, so I went to see my mother recommended her audiologist here at UCLA, Dr. Ishiyama. I went to see him, and I thought I had tinnitus. He said, "No, you're just having a nervous breakdown. There's nothing wrong with your ears." So, but we got to talking. He said, "Well, what are you working on?" I said, "Well, I'm working on this thing about opioids." And he said, "Oh, you know, I actually have a lot of experience with that, because opioid abuse will cause hearing loss, and people will become so addicted to opioids that they will get, you know, massive hearing damage. Maybe it's from the other, you know, what the pain pills are cut with. I can't remember, it's ibuprofen or whatever. You take too much, it can do bad stuff to you, to your liver and other things." But he said, you know, so I'll have people come in to see me, and they've lost hearing, and they've got tinnitus killing them. You know, they go to sleep and wake up and they have so much pain, but they're so busy getting high that they push this aside. When they finally come to see me, they're half deaf. Sometimes I can't even restore their hearing, right? So I thought, oh my God, this is fascinating. He said, you know, you should really read this series of articles in the Los Angeles Times. They did a wonderful expose on Big Pharma. So I went and read I modeled the character after Dr. Ishiyama in the film, who's Gary Oldman's friend in the movie. That's an homage to him. He's listening. So I started to read the LA Times, and there was a great, great series of articles, really top journalism. And they have gone into some of the pharmaceutical companies and tried to understand what did they know about the dangers of these drugs, their potential to create dependence, oxycodone-based time-release medications that they made or had patents on. And did they share all of that information with the public? And did they, you know, try to move things around or get around the FDA? Some of the companies are on trial for this as we speak, although I'm skeptical much will happen to them. So then I called the reporter. I called Lisa Guerrion, and I said, you know, it's Nick Jarecki, and I want to do this movie. She had seen Arbitrage, my previous film with Richard Gere, and liked it. And she said, okay, well, let's go meet at the coffee shop. And so we had a series of meetings, and we really hit it off. And she said, you know, I want to see a movie about this. I want to see, it is, as you said earlier, Sonny, it's a topic that doesn't get enough attention. Even as much as it was on the front page at that time, you know, it was on the front page for the New York Times or the LA Times, the Elite, whatever, mm-hmm. It wasn't the broad public, I don't think, had, or even today has an understanding of how some of these things began in the lab or the boardroom. Then she said, I said, okay, well, where am I going to go? She said, well, I got the guy for you. You got to meet, you know, the guy from my articles, Steve Opperman, who was the Los Angeles sheriff who ran the undercover prescription narcotics task force with the DEA. And he had just retired a year earlier. So it was wonderful. I got to talk to him without any of the departmental blah, 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 blah. And so Steve and I just started meeting. And he's a great, crazy guy. He'd come over, he'd bring a suitcase full of guns. He's a gun nut and loves to go hunting and was, you know, and he's cool. He's like 6'6", half Asian, half, you know, something else, like Opperman. I thought he was Jewish. So one of my people, but the he started to share with me, you know, all these cases, right? Everything in the film, the cartels, the Armenians, the thing, it's all real. It's all just out of Steve's playbook. And so he would, you know, there was a real Minas, a real Armin, and he had sent all these guys up. The thing, they come in and they hold up a dog x-ray to get pain pills in the movie, in a scene at their fake clinic. That mm-hmm. came from Steve. He had said, I want you to go into that doctor, take a dog x-ray, see how far you could push him. So so he was a wonderful partner. He even came on set then, and I had him, you know, coach the actors and stuff. And so little by little, you know, then I happened to know people in the pharma world. So, you know, a good friend of mine runs a animal testing company, biotechnology company. And so she let me in the labs, and then all the science, you know, all those mouse cages, everything real, real, real. We just copied the designs. We made our own designs. She reviewed the science. So, so I have these wonderful advisors, you know, and that I think gave the tableau, you know, both Billy Friedkin and Michael Mann and Catherine Bigelow, I'm fans of all those directors. And they always go and get the consultants and get the research, and they make those people their friends. They live with them. They probably love them more than the movies, you know. And so I feel like you get that lived in feel, or you have a higher chance at least of getting it, you know, when you really take the time to do that. So and I enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it feels very lived in and real when you're watching it. It helps that you have one of the best casts that I've seen in recent memory here. I mean, you've got Gary Oldman, Michelle Rodriguez, Evangeline Lilly, who else? I mean, Armie Hammer. We'll come back to him in a minute. But it's just a
Greg
killer
Kinnear,
lineup.
Luke Evans,
Greg Kinnear, right?
Veronica Ferris, Martin Donovan for the Hal Hartley fans on the audience.
Exactly. You know, exactly. I mean, it's a killer cast. Yeah. So, I mean, did you? I'm always curious how directors go about building a cast, and with one this stacked. I mean, is it just a function of getting the script out there and they love it and they want to sign on? I mean, I find the casting process to be about as interesting as anything else in the world of making movies.
Well, it's a dark art, but you know, because you always feel a little bit. You know, on the one hand, you're like bringing people something cool and exciting. And on the other hand, you're like almost like a rug merchant where you're like, hey, I got my movie for you. If you sign on, I can get $100,000 from Germany. And, you know, so there it's madness because the financing entities drive you crazy with how famous is this person? What's their foreign value in Lithuania? Mm-hmm. You know, and you're like, hey, I'm just trying to make a movie and get the right person. Right. So with this movie, though, I had a real stroke of luck, which is. The first person I gave the script to was Gary Oldman. And I had met Gary, had another project I was writing, a historical epic thriller about early terrorism in America. And so I had met Gary for that right around the time of Darkest Hour. He'd been at a cocktail party at the Chateau Marmont celebrating the release. And his agent, whom I knew, you know, he said, well, hey, you want to meet Gary? Why don't you come by and say hello? And so I did. And we were talking about this other project at the time. And he was so kind. He said he liked Arbitrage, and he said, this sounds very interesting and fascinating character. Thank you for the opportunity to be considered. I thought this is Gary Oldman. This is you know, he's pretty good, you know. Yeah. But actually, it wasn't an act. He has a certain kindness to him and a certain respect. You know that I'm a junior classman three layers below, but he never treated me that way at all. So we were talking about that work, you know, that was very hard to get going. I need a lot of money. Anyway, I wrote this in about 6 months. I had another friend got in trouble and it felt like the right time. So then I gave him the script and he right away said, you know, okay, you know what? We want to do the other one. Let's do this now. This is urgent. I know about drug addiction. I have a history with, you know, my own friends and family, whatever. This and people need this, you know, because it's hitting everywhere. It's hit like category 5 and it's, you know, it's crossing over and people need to understand that. So let's do it. I'll come in as a producer, use my name and go get the money and get the rest of the people. And so, you know, so, and that was something, you know, in a way similar that I had had a similar thing with Al Pacino originally and then with Richard Gere in Arbitrage. So I have some type of, or at least I have up to this point had some type of appeal with these elder statesmen. Genius actors. I don't know. Maybe it's my charm might be wearing thin. You never know. But But so that's sort of how it then unfolded. And then I Evangeline Lilly, I'd always admired from Lost. I didn't know her, but I knew she had incredible emotional range because she played 150 episodes of, you know, okay, the sea monster ate your baby, or, you know, what, right. You just found out your boyfriend cheated on his taxes. Like, anything that could happen happened in Lost. So therefore, I knew she had the range to play any kind of emotion. And so she read the script, and she very quickly took to it. And then Army, I said the script. I had known him a little bit, had met him a few times in Hollywood before. And so we were kind of friendly. And he came in right away. And then the rest of the cast, now at this point, I said, okay, well, I got to get other great people in the movie. I don't have any more money. I mean, I didn't pay the leads very much, but then we really had nothing left. So then I just said, now I just got to start calling my friends. So I called Michelle Rodriguez. I called Lily Depp. I called Greg Kinnear. You know, these are friends that I've built up over the years, and Veronica Ferris and Cuddy. And I just said, listen, I'm doing this movie in Canada. It's an important topic. I think there's some good material here. I have no money for you, and you have to come and stay in a two-star hotel where it's freezing. What do you think? And pretty much to a man or a woman, everybody was like, I'll be there. What time do you need me? You know? And that was wonderful to have that support. And then there were some new people that joined that I didn't know that were just incredible actors. Indira Varma, whom I'd love from Game of Thrones, Martin Donovan, as I said, and Luke Evans, who really turned out to be this wonderful wonderful guy and such a big supporter of the film through thick and thin. And you know, he's such a great actor, and he really gave, along with Veronica Ferris, to my opinion, some dimension to the pharmaceutical executive role. And that was it. And off we went. And I mean, we had many, many challenges along the way. This was extraordinarily difficult production. Because I thought Arbitrage, we had had so much fun, and this certainly was a lot of fun as well, but I didn't, there were a whole new series of elements that I didn't really fully understand the ramifications, such as shooting in Canada in February in Montreal, where the average temperature is minus 30. Yeah. And the first day we were out there, lenses froze, I did my feet wrong. I mean, a frostbite. We had two actors got sick. We had to close the movie twice for a week at a time. Insurance, God bless Chubb Insurance. They paid millions of dollars of insurance claims. I mean, now we're finishing the movie. Now we get COVID. You know, now the movie can't come out. The movie's been done for 10 months. We thought it was such an urgent public health topic. And then in addition, we can't bring the movie out. You know, who cares about drug addicts, you know, who cares about those people? With people dying of COVID, what am I going to spare some time for, but I mean, that's the problem. There's always so many harms in this country that, you know, where can you put the energy? So, but look, in the end, it all worked out, and we'll get into that as well. But definitely some challenges.
Yeah, I mean, I like you mentioned just very briefly, you know, we can get 100K from Germany from this. And it was very interesting when I talked. I've talked to a casting director before on the show, and the idea of building a budget from the cast that you can get and can kind of pre-sale overseas, et cetera, is super interesting to me. I don't know why, because it's not on the screen, right? Except it does kind of wind up on the screen, because the bigger cast you can get, the more you can sell it for, the more money you get, the better it looks on screen. If there's any way you can just provide some insight into that world of foreign sales. I mean, I'm always interested in this.
Well, it's a world that's dying, and it was kind of a cool, as weird and difficult as it can be, there was something very cool about it, which is it was pretty democratic. In the sense that, you know, how do you make a film, right? Let's say that you, Sonny Bunch, decide you want to direct a movie. How are you going to get that done? Mm-hmm. I mean, do you have $10 million there in your under your desk? No, you know, most don't. So you got to go get it. So how do you get it? Well, under the original old studio system, you would go to Hollywood and you would go meet with Louis B. Mayer or whoever you would go meet with, you know, Nick Schenck. And they hear my movie, what do you think? And they go, no. Okay, and then if you got five no's, bye-bye, no movie, right? Yeah. And then also, how do you get on as a director, right? Because I also wrote a book called Breaking In, How 20 Film Directors Got Their Start, where I myself wanted to become a director. How do you become a director? So I went and interviewed 20 great directors about how they did that. And so that's the other thing, is how do you break in as a filmmaker into the studio system? Pretty much impossible, right? You would have to have someone touch you and say, yes, I bring him in. So you're dealing in a way with the sinecure, you know, and that is not democratic. It's unfortunate, right? And that's why a lot of voices weren't represented or weren't heard, you know, until now. There's a push for diversity and inclusion. I've been in the Directors Guild for now, I think, 10 years. And, you know, this is something we've been working on for years. Paris Barclay, especially the head of the DGA, pushing, you know, minority directors, women directors, trying to equalize where we were three years ago when we had 6% of features being made by women. It's ridiculous. But this, you know, has not been the case historically, right? So what was cool about the foreign sales model was now it was, okay, you don't have to get a studio to put a stamp on you to make your movie. You can go and put together a cast. And if you can get, you know, and there's all levels of cast. You could either get Tom Cruise, you know, as Paul Thomas Anderson did. I think that was in India. I can't remember, from Magnolia, or maybe not. You know, or you could get, you know, one of the filmmakers in my book told me it was a big day when they got Michael Ironside back in 1993 because he was worth $300,000 in Germany or whatever. Yeah. But the idea is there's all these distributors all over the world, Mr. Germany, Mr. France, Mr. Spain. And you could, if you put together a package, so you write a screenplay or you get a screenplay, you get a director or you are the director, and then you get a cast. Now, if you can, how do you get the cast? We'll get to that in a second. But if you can get a cast, then you can go to these Mr. Foreigns and you can say, here's what I got. What will you give me for this package? And there's three or four of them, and they bid because they need product. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, you need to have a certain level of cast. You can't do it with Nick Drake and Sonny Bunch starring it. We're not going to make it, you know. But you sadly, also don't need Cruz. You know, maybe you could do it with, you know, someone else, right? So someone lesser known. So if then essentially you could get a certain amount of foreign financing, and then you would get a tax credit, which is an automatic thing you can get from a government depending on where you shoot, right? Spend a dollar, we'll give you back 25 cents. Okay, that's a piece of my financing, extremely valuable. And then now you have to go out and raise a little bit of money for, you know, against the United States. But you can, but you have the other pieces. You have a cast, you have foreign sales, you have a tax credit. Raising the local money, not that hard now, you know, because you already put everything else together. So what it did was there was a democratic nature to it. Could you get the cast, right? And then how do you get the cast? Well, this was always a bit tricky, because is it merit or is it charm or is it social standing within the Hollywood system? You definitely need to play the game. You need to get into the Hollywood agency system, and how do I get this agent to give the script to the client? Because these movie stars are like hidden. You can never find these people. You don't have their telephone number. Sure. They have no way to reach them. But, you know, ultimately, if you have a good screenplay, that seems to be recognized, right? And because I've had screenplays that are good, and then I've had screenplays that aren't. It doesn't matter what my name is. If the screenplay wasn't good, it wasn't as easily recognized. And so, you know, so if you can get a good script, and if you have some promise as a director, you get some short film or something, and if you can kind of understand how this system works, you really could make a movie, you know, and you could get, and you had a great freedom in that system because you were assembling the financing yourself. So I've had Final Cut on every single one of my movies. I mean, I don't know any, very, very few directors have that, right? Yeah. So, you know, now that system is in collapse, which really is a shame. Because of the rise of streamers, Netflix, you know, they are dominating now the content in all those foreign territories. So as a result, the foreign independent companies don't have money to, like that, to give to pre-buys unless it's some like crazy cast, you know, Knives Out. And so it really becomes challenging. And I'm not sure there is an independent finance model through foreign sales at this point that's financially bankable, where I feel comfortable going to an investor and saying, I'm going to get you your money back, right? Because all my films have done well so far, you know, but people believing in you, you don't want them to get hurt. And you know, I also put my own money into these films. So it's tough now. I don't know what, I know this is a much different peg of the conversation than we were originally
on. No, I really do think it's super interesting. We try to talk about the business of Hollywood and filmmaking on this show quite a bit, so I like to get that side of things. With the movie kind of hitting as COVID hits, as theaters shut down, you know, as the world of film distribution itself kind of radically changes. I'm just kind of curious how you guys approached it. You know, did you sit on it for a while? Were you like, okay, theaters are going to come back, we're gonna be able to get this in theaters? What was that whole process like?
So we really, this was pretty wild. I was finishing up the movie, and I basically had locked the picture, and I had done most of the sound work, and I was still doing the color. And I was like sitting in these theaters because, you know, we shot this movie on 35mm and mixed it in Dolby on these big stages. And, you know, it's gorgeous. Like if you see a print of this movie projected, it, you know, or a DCP, like it really looks terrific. The cinematographer was great. We shot an anamorphic. And so Nicolas Bolduc won every Canadian Cinematography Award. So there I was, you know, puttering away in my color theater or whatever, like. And so we were starting to screen the movie because we never pre-sold the U.S. Typically, you try to keep that and sell that because that could be your profit center, mm-hmm. you know, and also it's hard to pre-sell unless you have, you know, Cruise or Pitt or whatever, Brad Pitt. So we were setting up all these screens for releasing companies, you know, to see who we want to work with and who want to work with us. And then they were like, oh, they can't make it. There's like a virus going around or, you know, anyway, before we knew it, everything was closing. Everything was shutting. And I had gone and made at Deluxe Lab. I had like a stack of DCPs that we were like getting out to the screening rooms, getting to the theaters. I'm like, well, I just gave the guy the DC. What do you mean it's a quick, you know, and they're like, no. So then it was, okay, wow, the whole world exploded. And then I couldn't even finish the picture now because all the labs are closed. So then we basically pressed pause for about 2 months. And finally they said, okay, well, now everybody's ready to buy again. So they're going to look on their laptop or whatever. So let's send links. And I mean, that was just terrible, right? Because, you know, there's a completely different experience when you show somebody a movie in theater with people or whatever than, you know, if they're watching it on their iPhone, for all I know, right? So, but, you know, look, we accept that, and that's the way it was. So we did the screenings, and we ultimately found a distributor that we liked, Quiver, small distributor. I knew those guys. What I liked about it was, you know, that going with them gave me a good deal of control. Every director likes control and a good financial deal. But because we wanted to do some theatrical release, and we had committed that to our international partners. We had pre-sold the movie to Universal and Warner Brothers, were the main partners. Mm-hmm. They had most of the territories of the world. So we told them we're going to do a theatrical movie, you know, and that helps with the press profile of a film. It's just treated differently than if it's a straight-to-video release, you know. But, you know, you got to go out there and do a few hundred theaters, right? So this was very difficult in the pandemic. So we did have to wait and wait and wait and keep figuring out when is that going to be a reality. And I think we went right at the start now that we're seeing theaters reopen. And I actually think it worked out quite nicely for us theatrically. I wish we could have gone 2 weeks later, but whatever. So we did that. But at the same time, we said, okay, well, I said, look, we got to do a day and date, you know. This was a model that I had done with Arbitrage, and we really, you know, I don't want to say we were the first, but we are to this date. Arbitrage holds the record as the highest grossing independent film of all time to ever be released day and date. And so I knew from my experience doing that there was a theatrical experience and a home video experience audience, and that it didn't upset them to serve one and serve the other.
Yeah. When you say highest grossing, do you mean combined between VOD and box office?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So we did with Arbitrage, and this is in 2012, 2013. We did about 8 million on 200 screens, and then we did another 14 or 15 million on the US VOD. Mm-hmm. And so for an indie, that is still the record. as far as I know. So I knew that that was, you know, it could work. And I thought, especially in the pandemic, it would work. Use the theatrical to generate and drive the press awareness, ride that into the VOD. I mean, this is, people have become more aware of this. This is not, you know, now it's not rocket science the way it was back then. But, you know, look, it worked. So we opened up 216 screens wherever we could. And for the pandemic, we did great. We did $900 a screen. We were the number two highest grossing film per screen and the highest grossing film in limited release. And we held for a few weeks and we made some money there. I mean, look, we made $500,000 with Arbitrage, the same number of screens. I made $8 million 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So obviously the pandemic was a big hit, you know, to the revenues. But then on VOD, it did work. We went onto iTunes. We were number two within 24 hours. And we were number one within 3 days. And we held that for almost 2 weeks. And so people got to see the film on VOD. Do I, you know, wish they'd seen it in the theater? Of course, you know, but at least they saw it and they continue to see it.
Yeah. And as we said, it's hitting DVD and Blu-ray now. So if you're into the whole physical media thing, check it out there. I love this conversation because I have no idea really what the finances of VOD and DVD and all that look like. Nobody really does. It's kind of a black box. So it's always very interesting to get kind of a glimpse into that here. And, you know, one of the things you mentioned is the difficulty in getting attention for a VOD movie. I mean, it has a tendency to get lost in the shuffle, even with something as well cast and with like Oscar winners and Oscar nominees, et cetera, like this, and a timely topic and all that. But there was another issue, and this is kind of how I came across your radar, I think, the whole Army Hammer situation. And I don't want to get into all of that, except to ask what it's like to have to be marketing a film when one of your stars, and I think who gives a very, very good performance in this movie, is embroiled in a controversy that causes a certain number of critics and writers to shy away from the project altogether.
Well, Sonny, you know, it was pretty frustrating, I have to say. I'm very much a man of action, but sometimes I've been accused by certain past girlfriends or whatever of not being emotional enough when it counted. So sometimes I can get paralyzed, and that happened here a bit. I really didn't know what to make of things. I knew, you know, the stuff started coming out about Army. I just want to be clear. I have no knowledge of anything. I'm not in touch with him. I could be completely innocent of anything. It could all be true. I have no idea. The person that I knew, you know, was very considerate and hardworking. And I also think did good work in the film. But all this stuff is coming out. And then it's okay. Well, what, I mean, this just gets wilder by the day. Right. And so at first it's sort of innocuous, oh, the cannibal, blah, blah. But then it's, you know, oh, was it an abuse? And so, you know, so I saw, okay, this is taking a darker turn, but what are we going to do? Should we cancel the release? Should we postpone the release? Well, we really can't do that. There's a lot of financial considerations at play here. You owe a bank money who's financed all of these sales, right? So, and we got to just keep moving ahead. There's so much other good work in this movie. You know, so we said, okay, well, hopefully this won't impact reception. But it did, you know? I mean, it impacted us on many, many, many levels. It continues to impact us. I have, I can't get too deep into it, but we have a release now. You know, we have still many, many countries of the world we haven't released. They were going to do a big release there. Now they're not going to do a big release there because of the Army Hammer factor or the press factor or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that is a shame, you know. It, right or wrong, I mean, it's really just very frustrating. So we had, you know, tons of press coverage lined up and the cast here and there. And then it just evaporated, you know. It was, I think, and in a way, you know, who can blame them? But I think some of these organizations as organizations were concerned and say, oh, well, we just did a great feature on this movie and we had, you know, Vanity Fair with everybody, you know, pictures, the cast, and Lily Depp, and, you know, and then it's like, oh, and by the way, now this guy was a serial killer, you know, which was a rumor that was being floated at one time. They thought he was a serial killer, which of course is insane, I think. You know, what do you do? So then the cast, you know, their representatives didn't want them to do stuff. So basically just all went away. It was me going out there and promoting the movie and you know, a bit of support from the cast on social media, which is the thing they can do by themselves, right? And then, so then it was, okay, well, what's the reception of the movie? So I had, you know, one thing I always knew about this movie is I went into a very long editing process on this movie. I think I spent 7, 8, 9 months editing it. And I had, you know, I'm a social person, so I'm friendly with a lot of other directors through the Directors Guild and other places. So I had, you know, called all my friends, as I always do. You know, hey, I made a movie, come on over. What do you think? So we got Eli Roth in here. We got Taika Waititi. We got Tony Kaye. Like, you know, whoever it was, I brought him in. I mean, I couldn't get Kathryn Bigelow. But, you know, and then at the same time, so we did all these notes and Mark Forster, we did it, you know, and then I tested the movie and I hadn't tested movies before and it tested well. And I went there and sat there with the audience and participate in the Q&As, you know, so I knew, I was like, okay, this is good. You know, these scores are good.
Yeah.
So then, you know, then we sent it out for advanced reviews before all the controversy. We got back raves. You know, people gave us advanced quotes to put on the poster. This is timely. It's intense. Great performances. And you know, then the thing happened. And then I first few reviews came in. Deadline, Variety, they were good. I'm like, okay, we're fine. And then just boom, there was this torrent of hatred. You know, true abuse of the movie, of me. I don't know. A lot of it was focused on me. Somehow I had. I don't know what I did to these folks. I'm sorry for whatever I transgressed. You know, but it was confusing as a filmmaker, because you're always trying to say, well, where could I do it better? You know, did I fail? Did I let the people down? Is this really not a good movie? I mean, we had a 24 at one point on Rotten Tomatoes. Now we're in the 60s. But you know, so it was very confusing. And I just sort of, because as an artist, you're always extremely self-critical and you want to, you know, believe, oh, it's all my fault. I just, you know, I screwed everything up. But as I started to read a bunch of the hatred ones, right, there are certainly some people who don't like the movie, and that's fine. You know, they give it a bad review, whatever. It's not for them. I mean, there's a lot of people that liked it, even at this time. But still, you know, as I read, it was very Hammer-focused. You know, it was very Hammer-focused. And I just didn't think that was fair to the rest of the film. You know, to the other cast and to what we were trying to do, which was to get the word out about a topic that I thought we did in a decent way, you know? So, and it was weird. You know, it was weird to see that there was kind of like it seemed like a pylon effect to some extent. So I'll read you something. Somebody posted a comment somewhere online, where they didn't like, people had rated the movie high, and they said, wow, it must have been all the people that actually worked on the movie leaving high ratings for this awful stinker. It must be a fake rating system. The movie from beginning to end was dreadful. The acting subpar at best. Armie Hammer is one of the worst actors in Hollywood. Armie Hammer is not only a woman beater, he's also one of the worst choices to pick for any kind of movie. Basically, I really just hate Armie Hammer. Even seeing his stupid name irritates me to no end.
Yeah. Yeah.
What, how could I have made that movie better for that person? I don't think I could have, you know? So to me, that's where the frustration came to say, that's not real. That's not about the movie, you know? And then that was when we said, okay, can we, you know, let's get out of this paralysis and let's start just doing more press by whatever means we can, a grassroots approach, you know, reaching people like yourself, reaching, you know, I reached my, you know, other friends and critics and film writers, and just saying, like, can we get a reevaluation of this movie? You don't have to like it. You know, if you don't like it, that's fine. But can we just take a look, you know, without the noise of, you know, because his thing when the movie came out, it was literally like he was being tried in the court of media every day. Right. Yeah. So it was perfect storm happening there. And I'm glad to say I feel that we've been successful. You know, I think now there have been, you know, 50 or 100 more journalists have written about it. You know, some really intelligent commentary. There's this one guy I cite all the time that he made this video that I loved. Dom Griffin, the armchair auteur. He made a video on YouTube. He posts these incredibly complex, crazy reviews. And he said it was called "What Happens to the Movies When Their Star Is Canceled." And it was a review of Crisis, which he liked, you know. But he was like, I like the movie. You know, was it my favorite movie of the year? No, but I do like the film. It's a good film. But let's look at the army of it all. And he went deep and deep. And so he's very fun. Check him out. Dom Griffin. So I don't know. I mean, that's it. That's the dialogue. What can you do? I mean, we have to fight for the movie. We believe in this movie. All the cast believed in it. There's a lot of good work in the movie. You know, whether you some people think it's a work of great genius. Others think it's horrible. Whatever it is, it's, you know, I know what I'm doing as a filmmaker is pretty good. So, you know, but hopefully also it just advances the opioid discussion, because that got swept away in COVID. And, you know, and that's, we're trying to put that back to the forefront, because as you started the program by saying, there's still legion deaths, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. And the opioid epidemic has only gotten worse during the pandemic. I mean, it's, you know, people are at home. People are just getting high and dying, and it's bad. We don't want that. I am curious. I just wanted to ask one more follow up on the review situation. So, I mean, do you feel that the internet has both, the sense I get from what you said is that the internet has both kind of democratized the review process, but also made it weirdly more vicious. And more kind of focused on whatever thing can be dunked on at any given moment.
The problem to an extent with film criticism as it stands today is, you know, I love film criticism and I really like critics. And, you know, like I used to write, you know, Paul Schrader was a critic before he was a filmmaker. So there, as was one of the great French auteurs whose name is escaping me at the moment, was it Louis Malle, or I don't know. But I've always really enjoyed reading film criticism. I, as a kid, I used to get, you know, read David Denby in New York Magazine, you know, and think like, oh my God, he's so smart. And, or A.O. Scott, you know, I've enjoyed his writing for a long time. But there was a tradition of Pauline Kael and Andrew Saris and these people that really took it seriously. So I'm the type of guy, like, I would go to the AFI library here in California and go through the stacks and find all the reviews of Robert Towne's movies from Sight and Sound and the AFI Journal or whatever. You know, I'm a big geek in that way. I think what's happened is, I dare say, tomatoes, you know. I want to be careful because I don't want to offend the wrong forces, but... I just think the tomatoization of it all, is it fresh, is it rotten? That's all the audience looks at now, you know? And even the providers, by putting the score there on the movie in iTunes or whatever, right? That's sort of like the Roman Colosseum thumbs up, thumbs down that Siskel and Ebert used to do. But at least, you know, Ebert, who was one of the loves of my life, he wrote the introduction to my book. I interviewed him for one of my documentaries. I thought he was a great man. They would do a thumbs up, thumbs down, but they would then do the whole, you know, first they'd do the whole discourse on the movie for 10 minutes and talk about what they felt about it, the themes, give intelligent analysis. Yeah. So now it's just become, everything's reduced to a score, you know, and what does that do to, you know, really kind of deep analysis? I think it's devalued film criticism, you know, and I think it encourages, you know, perhaps some bad instincts. And then now it's become, you know, I have to be honest, I this really troubled me. I caught some plagiarists on this movie. Mm-hmm. Four at people who went and took other people's reviews from Tomatoes, copied them, changed around a couple sentences, and printed them as their own, and then put them on Twitter in order to drive traffic to their site. And I read them and I went, you know, there's a particular turn of phrase in here I recognize. I mean, what do you do? I mean, I just literally wrote them. I was just like, just take this down. You know, they did. But that's not a good thing. You know, there needs to be a little more elegance to this. But I think that's got to come, you know, I don't know where it comes from. I don't know what the answer is. Mm-hmm. I don't. What do you think? What do you feel?
I if I knew how to solve the Rotten Tomatoes problem, I would be a wealthy man and an editor somewhere of high prestige. I think you're right, though. I do think that the issue is not so much the thumbs up and thumbs down of it all. I think there's always been an element of service journalism to criticism, telling people in shorthand, this is worth seeing, this is not worth seeing. But I do think the real problem is when Apple or when Comcast or Amazon or whoever also puts that little fresh or rotten badge up on the screen next to the movie, it unbalances the whole thing. It turns criticism into nothing but service, and I agree with you that it's a real problem, and one that critics kind of have to play, because if your stuff's not on Rotten Tomatoes, is it being read, right? That's always the fear. Like, if you're not a tomato certified critic, are you a real critic? Does your opinion matter? So I mean, it is a thing that definitely is almost unsolvable. I don't know what the answer is.
What's interesting is the I noticed this the other day. Maybe this is obvious, but the streamers do not put ratings for their own product.
Oh, really?
So if you go on Apple TV and it's an Apple program or Cherry, there's no score.
Mm.
If you go on Netflix, there's no score. But if you go on iTunes or Amazon for a VOD rental, there's always a score.
Yeah. Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, Amazon or Netflix does the whole, you know, percent match thing, which used to be a thumbs up or thumbs down rating, and they changed it to how well it matches whatever the algorithm thinks you want to watch, which is I don't know that a lot of people realize that the percent match score is not the what people think of the movie. It's what the algorithm thinks you want to watch, which is kind of interesting. Well, we've been talking for 47 minutes now, and I just want to ask. I always like to ask at the end of these interviews, if there was anything I should have asked, if there was anything that you would like to talk about that you think people should know, either about the movie or the opioid epidemic, if you want to talk about that, whatever.
I think we've really covered the waterfront. I mean, we were really proud of this movie, and you know, I'm a big believer in all's well that ends well. So you know, I think now the movie's back on the right path, thanks to folks like yourself, thanks to people who gave it another look, you know, and didn't consign it to the dustbin of history. I mean, that is an issue with these films. I think we've touched on a lot of really interesting things, which is curation, which is, you know, how do you mount a campaign to even get people focused on a film? I mean, there's so much attention has just gone away from film generally. You know, if it's not a big spectacle movie, how do these independent movies get attention? But I think, you know, I'm always, like I said, it was a bit paralyzed, but you know, where there's a will, there's a way. And now we're back on the right foot, and we're continuing to roll out into all these other countries. And so I do think this film will find its audience and continue to find its audience over time. And I and the cast are very grateful for that. I think as far as, you know, what we touched on with financing these films, maybe that's a similar thing. You know, I think the audience has to make their desires known somehow. You know, that they, if they want to keep seeing thoughtful cinema, drama cinema, thriller cinema, and not just the cinema of effects and spectacle, you know, that they've got to advocate for that. They've got to show the money people that they'll go for it. Yeah. You know, we were lucky they did that on iTunes, and that helped us, you know, helped us with everybody else we were dealing with. So we're very thankful for that. But I think, I don't know. I think it's, you know, that's also where the critic's role oftentimes was very powerful, that they could promote films that you didn't necessarily know about. You know, I mean, that's how we all found Reservoir Dogs. You know, remember, I saw some critic review and they're like, this movie's crazy. This guy's slicing off an ear. You know, I was 12 years old and I was like, okay, I got to go sneak into the Angelica to go see dogs.
Yeah.
So there have been, you know, these critics that have championed these films that then otherwise would have slipped through the cracks. And I think that's the critic's role too, you know. So for if you know, any critics who are listening, it's like, you know, you're super important. We need you. We need you more than ever. We need you to champion, you know, things that have merit and get them to rise above and not just make everything Godzilla versus Kong. You know, Godzilla versus Kong will take care of itself.
Yeah.
You know, and I know there's a tendency to be like, oh, well, I got to get my viewership or my ratings. That's what everyone wants to read about on my channel. And so, yes. Okay. Yes. But you know, it's in the film directing game, the expression was always one for the meal, one for the reel, you know? So it was like, okay, well, let's do a Godzilla Kong review for them, but let's also do a review of, you know, Pleasure or whatever weird, cool new indie movies coming that we want to get everybody to know about. You know, and thanks for the people who did it for Crisis. We really appreciate it.
Well, let's close on this ode to critics. We are the best. It's true. thank you. Thank you very much for being on the show. Nicholas Drecke is the writer director of Crisis. You can find it on VOD, Apple, Amazon, wherever, out on Blu-ray and DVD now. Check it out. It is well worth your time. I'm Sonny Bunch, and we will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains August 8th through the 14th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.